from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Media attention should cover all stages of the world's various conflicts and not just focus on what the UN Secretary General's deputy described as the CNN stage. Daniel Dickinson reports from the United Nations.
Jan Eliasson referred to the American News Channel during a briefing in the Security Council on the Secretary General's report on peacebuilding in the aftermath of conflict. Mr. Eliasson said the report is a reminder that peacebuilding is at the core of the United Nations' aims and ambitions. He said conflicts can be broken into different phases.
When we look at the life of a conflict, we have a tendency to focus on the middle section of that life of the conflict. When you are in the CNN stage, when you are in the stage of suffering and you taking urgent decision on peacekeeping operations, I think we need all to think of extending that attention to the pre-stage and the post-stage. The life of a conflict, we should discover the first vibrations on the ground. That's where we should start to act.
Mr. Eliasson also stressed that at the end of fighting, important work needs to follow to avoid getting back to what he called the vicious cycle of conflict. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
One place that drew close media scrutiny for a while last year and then slid off the radar is the east of Ukraine, where fighting has continued for months and thousands have lost their lives. On Wednesday, a civilian bus traveling from the city of Donetsk in the region came under rocket fire by the Ukrainian military, killing 11 people and injuring more than a dozen, all civilians. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon condemned the attack, as Stephanie Castro reports.
The shelling of a bus in eastern Ukraine, which resulted in the death of at least 11 civilians, has been condemned by the UN Secretary General. In a statement issued on Wednesday, Ban Ki-moon said the incident must be investigated and those responsible brought to justice. The Secretary General said he was deeply disturbed at the renewed escalation of fighting in the eastern Ukraine, despite a ceasefire that was agreed in September. He pointed out that the attack was a stark reminder of the urgent need to halt the violence that has already claimed over 4,800 lives, displaced more than 1 million people, and continues to cause needless harm and suffering to countless civilians. The Secretary General called on all sides to respect the truce and return to the implementation of the Minsk agreements, which he said remain a solid base for resolving the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Stephanie Castro, United Nations.
Donetsk's airport has been the focus of army assaults for months. It also came under intense shelling again Wednesday. RT's Maria Finoshina has more.
We received pictures from RT's video agency. Abruptly, the camera is targeting Donetsk City Airport that has been at the epicenter of the fighting for months. The shelling is quite intense. I spent many weeks in eastern Ukraine, in Donetsk, in other cities, in Donetsk Airport particularly. And from what I can see, I can say that it is a very heavy shelling. And earlier on Monday, we heard Russia's foreign minister saying that according to the sources at the Foreign Ministry, Kiev could consider military solution to this crisis. Well, unfortunately, it looks like still this place remains very dramatic and the situation there remains very tense.
Meanwhile, in the aftermath of last summer's bombing campaign against Gaza by Israel, many thousands of Gazans have been living through a freezing winter in tents pitched in the midst of the rubble of their ruined homes. While the UN continues to seek $500 million in emergency shelter aid for the war-battered region. RT's Rory Suchet has more.
Many houses and structures were destroyed, with entire streets left as piles as little more than just rubble. The situation in Gaza is also affected by a very tough winter. It's making the consequences of Israel's military operation even harder to deal with.
The situation is very difficult. The whole area is in ruins, and it's practically impossible to live here. Even the undamaged houses are not fit for habitation, and the freezing cold has only made matters worse. A week ago, the situation for all of us was unbearable. We are receiving help, but it is not enough.
It's very tough for us here. As you can see, we have no water or electricity. We are suffering badly. Children in this area are scared to go outside. After dark, you hardly see anyone on the streets. Everyone is terrified.
After the ceasefire, we headed to school, but soon we realized it had been destroyed. The classrooms had been burned down. Nothing was left. We pitched a tent to hold classes.
And although international organizations continue to supply Palestine with much-needed aid, it's just not enough to help the suffering civilians. In fact, the reconstruction of destroyed buildings and homes has barely begun. It's leaving people with no shelter in very low temperatures. Now let's have a look at some of the numbers for you here on the program. According to the latest data from the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, now nearly 2 million people in Gaza are in desperate need of health care. Almost the same number of people need water, sanitation and hygiene products. Also around 700,000 people are now homeless. And there is a scarcity of food, leaving over 1 million people suffering from hunger and malnutrition in Gaza. Human rights activist Amjad Al-Shawa, he says the situation, it's critical.
Last October, we have the donors conference for Gaza construction, which was held in Cairo, that there was about $2.7 billion that the international community was ready to pay as pledges for the Gaza construction. Till now, only 2% of this money arrived. We have no electricity. We have only 3-4 hours a day electricity. This lead for more freezing conditions, and at the same time that we are talking about health facilities, that it's only work for a few hours by the generators, and there is a shortage of medicine. At the same time, the water conditions in Gaza, that 96% of Gaza water is polluted, and no one can use it in the daily use. So it's really catastrophic conditions.
The freezing temperatures in Gaza claimed the life of another Palestinian baby in the war-ravaged city. An 18-month-old infant died in a caravan house in Khan Yunis from the severe cold, the fourth baby to die from cold in the past few days. International aid agencies have issued warnings that the severe weather conditions are life-threatening for those tens of thousands whose homes were destroyed during last summer's war and are still displaced, waiting for money to rebuild. About 100,000 buildings and structures were demolished during the Israeli offensive. Press TV's Ashraf Shannon reports from Gaza.
The situation in the Gaza Strip following Israel's 50-day war is beyond description. The pain and suffering just in the last few days with a cold front hitting the area, five people, including four infants, died. Two of the infants who died, one of them died in a caravan area where it shelters the displaced people. Another infant died in a UN school used for shelter. So if children die in shelters that are supposed to protect them from the elements, what can you expect with the people who are living, with the tens of thousands of people who are still living near their demolished homes or near the rubble of their homes? During the recent war on Gaza, around 100,000 homes were either completely or partially destroyed, and only a small repair was made to the partially damaged buildings. Now, the people in Gaza are blaming the international community's silence towards what's happening to them. They're also blaming the situation on the failure of the Palestinian Unity government to address the problems in Gaza. We shouldn't also forget the fact that the Israeli blockade also contributed to this situation, where for almost 8 years, Israel prevented the entry of building supplies, equipment, rescue equipment, and that also caused deterioration of the situation for the thousands of people who are displaced. For example, Khuza'a, where that 18-month-old baby died, there was a caravans area. It was an area has dozens of caravans. They're small. They're not suitable for people to live in them. And although the UN and other aid organizations were saying these houses were adequate, but they're not. People want to go back to their homes. They want to rebuild their homes, but Israel refuses to let them do that.
Civil servants in the Gaza Strip have not received their salaries and say that as a result, they are unable to make ends meet. They're calling on the Palestinian Unity government to take steps to ensure their pay. Meanwhile, following weeks of calm, tensions erupted in East Jerusalem and the occupied West Bank as Israeli forces detained 32 Palestinians, including children. Tell Us source Noor Harazin reports from Gaza.
Today in the Gaza Strip, there has been several protests for employees who did not get paid for the past months. They have been asking the Palestinian Unity government to take its responsibilities towards the residents of Gaza and help them getting paid as soon as they can, because as they expressed, they have no money left for them to leave to work and complete their daily work. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, tension is rising again after weeks of calmness. Last night, the Israeli forces detained 32 Palestinians in East Jerusalem and cities, different cities in the West Bank, including children and teenagers.
Attacks on Muslims and their property continue to escalate in France and elsewhere after last week's attack on the French magazine's headquarters in Paris. Saeed Mustafa Kosh-Shesh is a political commentator based in Tehran. He spoke with Press TV Wednesday.
You know that the Western media and media outlets and papers, they have been insulting Islam during the last three decades, especially after the Islamic Revolution, and it started with Salman Rushdie. But all throughout the last three decades, Muslims have never attacked to kill the press people and the journalists. But as soon as they released a cartoon about ISIL leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, then ISIL staged an attack and killed 17 people altogether in there. And right after that, Muslims rushed to the streets to condemn this act, to say that this is not Islam, we reject it. And this happened all throughout the world. In Iran, several officials, the leader's aide, top international aide, the foreign ministry spokeswoman, and others, they rushed to condemn the ISIL attack on the press in France. But this shows, this very fact shows that ISIL is totally different from Islam and its members are different from Muslims. Who has created ISIL? The West, the US-led West, France, and their main ally in the region, the Wahhabi regime of Saudi Arabia. And they have assisted ISIL by providing it with financial aids and arms and so on and so forth. Iran cautioned them not to do so, but they kept doing the same, practicing the same policy in support of ISIL in Syria. Very openly under the name of good and bad terrorists, and in Iraq, they are not hidden ISIL targets. So they are now, it seems that they are now using ISIL for their political incentives. One should ask why, when they released a cartoon about ISIL leader and they were attacked by ISIL, why in return they have released a cartoon about Muslims' prophet. This is a provocative act. They want to stop dialogue between the interfaith dialogue between Islam and Christianity, and on the other hand, promote Islamophobia. And they have succeeded to some degree, actually, in the last 10 days, to gather all the fascists and radicals together in order to promote the Islamophobia. But one last point is, if you really condemn terrorism, if you really are out to support the victims of terrorism in France, that's good. We also have sympathy for you. But why didn't you feel sympathy for the 2,000 people who were killed and slaughtered in Gaza? Why did you allow the head of a child killer regime, the Zionist regime, its prime minister, Netanyahu, to join the Je suis Charlie rally? Why don't you ever say Je suis Gaza?
Last week's attack on the staff of the French periodical is not the only such assault on the press to occur in the recent period, as the head of UNESCO, Arina Bakova, said Wednesday at an event at UNESCO headquarters titled Journalism After Charlie, Day of Reflection and Debate on Freedom of Expression.
The attack against Charlie Hebdo was an attack against freedom of expression, a pillar of this shared vision, whose flag bearers are journalists. The numbers are staggering. Every 7 days, one journalist is killed for doing his or her job. 9 out of 10 cases go unpunished, and this is simply unacceptable.
What do police terror in the U.S., Ebola in Africa, anti-immigrant attacks in France and elsewhere, and questions of freedom of the press arising from the Charlie Hebdo and Sony hacking cases all have in common? Deirdre Griswold is an author and commentator and a regular contributor to Workers' World newspaper. She spoke in New York last Friday about the common thread connecting these seemingly unrelated matters.
First of all, I wanted to say Black Lives Matter, and something like that should be universally recognized. They're taken for granted, of course, Black Lives Matter. However, what should be self-evident to everybody has to be fought for. And at last, we have the rise of this wonderful new movement to shake up the racist status quo. But the same thing goes for other manifestations of national oppression. Don't Arab lives matter? Don't Muslim lives matter? And remember when Ebola looked like it might spread to the U.S. and Europe? Then it was front page news. Well, it hasn't spread here, but it continues to claim thousands of lives in West Africa. But Ebola is not in the headlines anymore. What's the not so subtle message? African lives don't matter. When the U.S. drones wipe out a wedding party in Pakistan, or their artillery obliterate a village in Afghanistan, is it news? When Al-Qaeda or the Nusra Front kill people in Syria or the Kurdish areas, the main concern expressed here is how this will affect Washington's plans for the area. The Muslim lives don't matter. When the U.S. invaded Iraq with shock and awe, when it provided planes and funding to bring down the Libyan government, when it supplies the opposition, as they call it, in Syria to kill tens of thousands and displace millions of people, it's treated like a footnote. Doesn't matter. But when some group, and we really don't know who they are, carries out a bloody attack on a newspaper in Paris, then every columnist here and in all the imperialist world must comment on it. Every channel must give us the latest news, even if it's just speculation. Countries and prominent individuals have to make official statements or be charged with being soft on terrorism. All the lives being snuffed out by the Western imperialists don't matter. But these in Paris do. That's the real message. Needless to say, we Marxists have no ideological affinity to Al-Qaeda, if that's who the attackers really were. On the other hand, the U.S. and European imperialists have no problem in principle with Muslim fundamentalists, if they're like those who run some of the oil-rich states in the Middle East. No matter how much women may be oppressed or they virtually imprison immigrant workers, if they protect the imperialist interests, then they're okay. How does someone right now living in a Muslim or Middle Eastern country feel about the furor raised over the attack on Charlie Hebdo, the French magazine? Can they possibly not see this double standard in the media and politics of the so-called free democratic world? Think about the Palestinians, for example. They're not for Al-Qaeda, but they must be saying, where was this level of anger and condemnation when Gaza was being bombed every single day last summer by the Israelis? Don't our lives matter? It took more than 2,000 Palestinian deaths, including more than 500 children, to arouse some sympathy in the capitalist media. So that's one aspect of this development that just happened. Another is the issue of free speech, which is being raised to pass off degrading images of oppressed people as satire. We've recently seen the same thing here in the U.S. government's defense of the film The Interview, which not only is grossly insulting to the leader of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, but encourages murdering him by treating his fictional assassination as a laughing matter. And the State Department actually worked with Sony on shaping that film, by the way. At one time, and to some extent still, but not as much, racist, sexist, and homophobic images in this country were the norm, especially in the so-called entertainment industry. And so, by the way, was the practice of making so-called jokes about disabled people. Remember that? They were called sick jokes. It has taken many, many struggles to make it clear that cartoons, jokes, ads, and movies that perpetuate degrading stereotypes of oppressed people will not be tolerated. This didn't happen because of official government censorship. It happened because of countless protests and boycotts. Now, I don't know firsthand about the situation in France, but I do know that far-right parties there and in other parts of Europe are openly attacking immigrants, especially from Islamic countries, in a style reminiscent of the KKK here. Not only Islamic countries either. Roma people also are under attack, and some from Eastern Europe too. Poor people, in other words. Any culture that feeds into this bias is reactionary, no matter what it calls itself. One question we need to ask about the massacre that just happened at the newspaper Charlie Hebdo is, who gains politically from it? I think it seems pretty obvious that this event strengthens Islamophobia and anti-immigrant forces, not just in France, but throughout Europe and the US. We don't know if the story put out by the police is true or not. One person that they had claimed was the third man has turned himself in, probably fearing that otherwise he could be shot on sight by the cops. He proved that he was in school at the time that this happened. And what about the identity card supposedly found by the French police in the getaway vehicle? Does that really fit in with the military-type precision of these assailants? We need to have an open mind and not just accept the police story. You always have to take into account who benefits from such an act. The classic case was the Reichstag fire in 1933, an arson fire that burned part of the German parliament building. The Nazis blamed the fire on a young communist, and this was the excuse to launch a bloody attack on the left and the German working class, which accompanied Hitler's rise to power. Right-wing groups are again on the rise in Europe. They are blaming the continent's growing economic woes on immigrants and trying to turn the anger of the workers and small shopkeepers against foreigners. These foreigners come from the same countries that were plundered during colonialism. Europe grew wealthy on their backs, but colonial rule reduced them to poverty and underdevelopment, which has lasted right through the neocolonial era today. Most of the world is still dictated to by the imperialist banks. This is what has forced so many in Africa and Asia to leave their homes and look for work in Europe. What the European workers need to know is that their problems come from capitalism, not from immigrants.
Meanwhile, here in the U.S., the thin blue line stands between the victims of police violence and justice. Black Agenda Radio's Bruce Dixon has more.
There's a potent and powerful racist and classist myth that tough cops, jailers, judges, and prosecutors are all that stand between us and rampant crime, anarchy, and ruin. For American politics, it's an increasingly necessary fantasy, a myth that generations of public officials, from jailing judges and hang-'em-high prosecutors to lock-'em-up legislators, sheriffs, governors, and even presidents, have based their careers upon. The myths are necessary because no modern society can openly abandon its duty to provide its people quality educations, decent housing, living wage jobs, and economic security unless it is willing to brand large numbers of those to whom it won't provide education or housing or jobs and a dignified retirement unworthy, undeserving, and irredeemable. The American political class of both parties, including black politicians, stopped even talking about any rights to full employment, decent housing, and economic security and the like a generation ago, preferring to pretend that there is no alternative. Thus, the myths of the trifling, lazy, drug-addled, crime-ridden, mostly black and brown poor are essential to the stability of America as we know it. These myths are the ethical and the moral justification of the neoliberal economic order and its prison state. Over-policing and mass incarceration don't just happen because the cops are racist, the prosecutors corrupt, and the legislators and media vicious and cowardly, nor because they're driven by the profits of private prisons or captive labor. America's savage police and prison states provide us with a long-running reality show that justifies our profoundly unequal and unjust social order. They give us a morality play that casts the criminalized and mostly non-white poor as villains, kept at bay by the heroism of that thin blue line, while schools, roads, parks, public works, nature, and even water are privatized, while private and public pensions are looted, while student loan debt, black unemployment, and underemployment continue to rise, and while wages continue to fall, while child homelessness is at an all-time high and there are more vacant homes than homeless people, and while the rich and famous are celebrated and lionized for being famously rich. This is something that politicians from the president down to local mayors and aldermen know, and top cops from Homeland Security and the FBI to state and local departments know as well. It's something those in motion in the streets today over the last dozen and the next dozen police atrocities must better understand and articulate. The burgeoning movement against police immunity and impunity really is a threat to so-called national security, a menace to the privileges of banksters and employers, of privatizers and gentrifiers, the prerogatives of the 1%. When more of them openly question these prerogatives in the same breaths as they do the privilege of cops to murder and maim with immunity and impunity, we'll be a long step closer to a better world. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.